Henry David Thoreau said something rather gorgeous. He said, "My desire for knowledge is intermittent, but my desire to bathe my head in atmospheres unknown to my feet is perennial and constant." This ideal shaped his approach to learning, and it's just one of the reflections on knowledge, education and ignorance that editor Lewis Lapham has assembled in the latest Lapham's Quarterly on Ways of Learning. He also includes the writings of George Steiner, Charlotte Bronte, Salvador Dali and many, many, many others to understand the ideals of learning and how they fall short in the education systems. Welcome to the Book Show again, Lewis Lapham.
Thank you for having me back, Ramona.
Well, you write about a teacher who lit a fire for learning for you. Most of us have had one of these fantastic people. Who was yours?
Mine was a man named Charles Mulholland, who I encountered as a seventh grade student in San Francisco, California. And he taught history, but he taught it in such a dramatic and vivid way that he made the stories of the ancient Roman Republic come alive, and as near to hand as the ball game going on outside the school window. We could see the elephants coming over the Alps and know what happened at the Battle of Cannae and so on. But he managed to always bring it into a present context. He had a sense of the continuum. He knew that the American Republic was modeled on what our founding fathers believed to be true of the Roman Republic. And the Roman Republican ideal was very much to the front of the minds of the people in Philadelphia in 1787 when they wrote the Constitution. So that when Mulholland in the San Francisco classroom is defending the Roman frontier against Hannibal's elephants, he's also developing or defending the frontiers of the American Republic against the armies of ignorance and superstition.
So what was his methodology, Charles Mulholland? How did he make those elephants so alive for you?
Well, he used a blackboard. I mean, this is long ago and far away before computers and video applications. So he would draw maps on the blackboard. And then it was the force of his eloquence and his passion for the story of history that gave it life and pith and moment.
You mentioned long ago and far away, and later in your after your introductory essay in this a journal, you've said more broadly that the history of education reveals where the format of the dominant lecture mode comes from in the university setting. But Graham Burnett thinks that Google's going to change all this. So we're going to move from that long ago and far away blackboard and the person sitting in front of a group of people and lecturing. What does Graham Burnett think?
Well, Graham Burnett is a professor of science, the history of science at Princeton, and he has had the experience of giving lectures in to large numbers of students, and then he notices in the auditorium or the amphitheater in the middle of his lecture that at least half the class or maybe two-thirds of the class is studying their own laptop computer, and who knows what they're doing. I mean, they may be off in at a ball game somewhere, or they may be reading a contradictory text in the same subject that is being lectured about and already discounting it because in their computer they can draw upon any number of sources so that they are difficult to reach in the large-scale lecture format because either their arguments are going on unheard or unexpressed. I mean, the arguments are taking place not with the lecturer but with the with the computer, or they're AWOL in some form of more amusing entertainment. So in order to reach them, Burnett takes a number of students every year on field trips, a small number of necessity, maybe 12 or 16. And if they're going to study marine life, they may go to a camp somewhere in the Baja California and look at the fish or study the currents or try to have a more hands-on approach to the topic than likely to come from the pages of a printed book or from a computer text. And it's some kind of a combination of the field trip, the small room relation, but a seminar instead of a large lecture that Burnett is struggling toward.
I mean, this has been a debate in education for years about, you know, the difference between experiential ways of teaching and the idea that you fill up an empty vessel with information. And look, there's a hilarious essay written by a teacher of history, Anders Henriksen, compiled from the essays of students over 15 years of being a teacher, and it was just so hysterical. I mean, if you've ever taught, anybody knows this. I mean, you would have collected your own little group of fantastic sentences. And this guy has written an essay made up of these sentences. And since you were so interested in Rome, let me just read for people the paragraph on Rome. He's got, "Rome was founded sometime by Uncle Remus and Wolf. Roman upperclassmen demanded to be known as Patricia. Senators wore purple tubas as a sign of respect. Spartacus led a slave revolt and later was in a movie about this. The Roman Republic was bothered by intestinal wars. Caesar inspired his men by stating, 'I came, I saw, I went.' He was assassinated on the Yikes of March when he's reported to have said, 'Me too, Brutus.'" That is a very it's a hysterical thing. I mean, it goes on and on. But I suppose
but he's actually quoting phrases from students' papers.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. That's the tragedy of it.
Yeah, it's right. There are. It's hard to impress upon kids the story of history unless it's told well. And one of the problems with the American school system is that the story is not told well. Kids are given textbooks written in almost unreadable prose and asked to memorize large generalization and abstraction, and it's not a very stimulating approach. The whole point of education, I think, ought to be to awaken in the excitement of the mind in the student, his or her own mind, and to give the student confidence in his or her own mind.
But there is a notion here that those who now go into teaching are those who are kind of lackluster, the middle order student who can't think of something better to do.
Well, I mean, you know, that's always been a difficulty. We don't pay our teachers very well. It's a profession that is not granted much prestige in our society, and so we don't. It's an art form, really, teaching, I think, and but we don't regard it as such, and that's it's hard to get around that bias. There are a lot of marvelous teachers in the United States in schools of all levels. Not just in the Ivy League, but in community colleges and grammar schools and high schools. They're people of immense dedication, conviction, passion, eloquence, but they're few in number.
Well, I'm speaking to Lewis Lapham, editor of Lapham's Quarterly, on the book show here on ABC Radio National. We're talking about education. That's the subject of the latest Lapham Lapham's Quarterly. We can all agree that education is very important, but questions about what should be taught, I suppose they're less absolute. You've got an essay by George Steiner in it, the literary critic, and it's kind of surprising because he's saying we should all be versed in four areas that we should have literacy in, and what are they? Biology, mathematics, music, and architecture. And let's talk about why he's turned away from the humanities, where you might have thought he would have put his bets on.
Well, because I think he sees the modern world being consisting of numbers, and thus his emphasis on numeracy. I mean, whether you're studying math, music, architecture, or biogenetics, which are his four major fields of study, it comes down to the architecture of numbers. And he looks around our modern world, looks at the financial system, for example, where the computers that are set up on a binary system, or the buildings in the that are you see in the modern New York or Shanghai, which are and that's our environment. And so he's suggesting that we get to know our environment. I mean, that is his argument. And I can take a lot of his point. I mean, I went through a first-rate liberal education in the United States and never really had to confront economics or genetics. I mean, my ignorance is appalling in terms of the how the world is put together, what it's made of, what the how the great God money operates. So I see what Steiner's driving at.
Yeah, but I did the opposite. I had a scientific education, so I'm always attracted to the things that I think aren't explained by science, because I hope that there's going to be some kind of revelation in literature and philosophy and all of those areas. And is it just about the things that we don't know about? We're very romantic about the possibilities around them. I mean, which is kind of because we're curious, and if you're interested in learning things, you're interested in learning things that you don't know yet.
That's absolutely true. But how you learn and through what medium is changes. This is the point of McLuhan's book, Understanding Media, which was published in 1964, and he says that we shape our tools, and then our tools shape us. So much of what we now know as the humanities takes place in the kingdom of print. Mm. And the sensibility that is formed by the constant watcher of television, or consumer of visual images, we learn to think in a different way. I mean, it represents an overthrow of both a political order and an aesthetic order. It's a profound change in the way we process information. And Steiner, like McLuhan, like a number of other people, I mean, whether they're talking about the Internet or MTV or split screens or iPhones, are really talking about systems of education, which are also systems of knowing. How do we know what we know, is the question.
Well, the notion of genius stands out also as a conundrum for education. Some of the pieces you include suggest that mass education is against genius figures, like Salvador Dali rebelling against his art education, telling his examiners that he was more intelligent than them. And you include a list of famous dropouts like F. Scott Fitzgerald, Frank Lloyd Wright, Bill Gates. Now, where do we put those in our education system?
Well, maybe we don't. I mean, there are many other ways to learn outside the boundaries of the formal school system. There is a large number of people in the United States today that are homeschooling their children. There are another large group of people that are going to schools that have a very specifically religious framework. People can learn, people can get confidence in their own mind and learn to the excitement of learning. That is, in any number of ways. You can learn it by becoming a chef or a carpenter or a trader on the stock market. There shouldn't really be a hierarchy of which subjects are more useful than others. I mean, the notion of the liberal education today, as it is presented in the American high-tier American universities, really is a formality. Mm. It's a convention. I mean, it's in order to present the graduate with a credential that will certify him for employment on Wall Street or in the professions or in the government.
Well,
it doesn't really. It a lot of that doesn't really get to the point.
Well, the point is in many and varied, and as usual, it's in a cornucopia called Lapham's Quarterly, devoted to ways of learning this time. Lewis Lapham, thank you so much for being on the book show again.
Thank you, Ramona.
And the next one is on Eros, so we'll talk about Eros soon. And
yes,
after that, Crime and Punishment. Forward to it. Thank you so much. On ABC Radio National, I'm Ramona Koval.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.